All right. Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Justice Sue Walker is to my right. Justice Bill Meyer is to my left. And I'm Chief Justice Terry Livingston. We have two cases on our 10:30 docket. We will go through them directly one after another. First case we're going to hear is guardianship of Young Lo Yang. Cause number 216353CV, and it looks like all counsel have checked in, and I understand Mr. Kinsley and Mr. Paulson will share their time. Are you going to keep track of your own time, or usually we ask the appellants to divide their time, and we show it on the recording device, and it will tell you, the lights will tell you. Otherwise, the lights won't come on till almost the end of the 15 minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. My name is William Isaac. It's a pleasure to be before the court. I was barred in November of last year, so Mr. Paulson and I will switch time as needed. I'll begin, and I'll make sure to be very conscious of any time that I might need to.
Okay.
Paulson to step in after I'm completed it.
And tell me, you're William Kinsley?
Nicely, yes.
Nicely. Okay. Sorry about that.
My English teachers were never getting it right in high school, so I can't blame them.
Well, I don't even think I had it spelled correctly. So, anyways, we'll let you all work it out, but when we get to the yellow light, that means who's ever up there, you've just got, 2 minutes left at that point, all right? And then on Appalese side, we have just Mr. Henry arguing, is that correct?
Yes, Chief.
Okay. All right, we'll begin then with Mr. Nicely.
May it please the court. My name is William Nicely, and I, along with my co-counsel, David Paulson, we represent the appellate, Chinhua Wang. Grace in this matter. In preparing for this argument today, I had more than 2 days, and I'm grateful for having more than 2 days to prepare. Chinhua Wang didn't have 2 days to prepare for the guardianship hearing. And as we sit here and go through this hearing, I'm grateful that we're able to do it in English. We're not in Russia speaking Russian or having to translate into Chinese. Ms. Wang's native language is not English. And so to participate in that guardianship hearing, she needed a translator. Appellant has submitted 6 issues before the court. Now, to address those 6 issues, I'd like to submit 3 points. First is that this appeal of the temporary guardianship is not moot. Second is that the Denton County Probate Court abused its discretion when it ordered the guardianship, and the Denton County Probate Court violated my client's right to due process of law when she held the hearing on 2 days' notice, didn't provide for a court-certified translator, or both. And the third point is that the Denton County Probate Court abused its discretion when it required Grace to pay for 20% of the attorney ad litem's attorney's fees. Before I begin, I'd like to go over a few key facts in this matter, including the timeline. Grace was served with process on November 18th, 2015. That's indicated on page 52 of the clerk's record. The hearing was on November 20th. The TRO was not on file until after that hearing started. The temporary guardianship and the temporary restraining order were ordered on November 24th, 2015. And shortly thereafter, appellees withdrew their request for the TRO and canceled their TI hearing. The physician's certificate was not signed until November 25th, 2015. It was not on record until December 16th, 2015. And the court investigator's report was not on record until December 17th, 2015. Deborah Jones, the attorney ad litem in this matter, admits during the hearing that she did not get Grace's side of the story, yet she felt compelled to continue with the guardianship hearing. The probate court, in its findings of fact and conclusions of law, stated that Grace, and I quote, acted in bad faith and without just cause in objecting to the application for temporary guardian. Beginning with the appellant's first point, this appeal is not moot. Section 1152.001 of the Estates Code does not explicitly authorize or require an interlocutory appeal of guardianship hearing or an appointment of a guardianship. Even in Appellee's brief, they cite to a case that interprets this statute. The statute itself is silent as to specifically requiring an interlocutory appeal, and Rule 28 of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure, 28.1A, discusses how for an interlocutory appeal, it's where authorized by law or by statute. That's not the case in this scenario. Now, because of that, this case is distinguishable from a lot of other cases, including in Ray Fulbright in regards to the guardianship of Fulbright and in Ray Linda Jane Hart, which are two Fort Worth Court of Appeals cases. They've Lexis citations. In those instances, the Court of Appeals was addressing an interlocutory appeal. In this instance, we have an appeal from a final order wrapping up the guardianship. That's distinguishable. In Fulbright, the guardianship was ordered sometime in July 2015, I believe. The due date was sometime in August, according to the court. And the interlocutory appeal was not filed until 2016. So this case is distinguishable in that we now have a complete guardianship that's been wrapped up, and now we have filed an appeal challenging the application of the guardianship. The Supreme Court in Brittingham Sada de Alaya, versus Mackey, a 2006 case, recognizes the inherent difficulties in this area of law. And the Supreme Court of Texas in that case does encourage but does not require severance orders. Going backwards in time, in 1995, the Supreme Court of Texas in Crossan versus Wakeham stated that the court in this area of law is mindful of developing policy that does not stop an applicant from having a bona fide appeal, and that's exactly what's happening in this case. We're not here to argue the window for the interlocutory appeal. The appeal in this matter happened within time after the guardianship was wound up. Therefore, this case is not moot. We just have a different type of case.
Is that distinction based in any part upon the fact that it was merely a temporary appointment? I mean, an appointment of a temporary guardian as opposed to the more final permanent guardianship appointment?
No, Your Honor, and the way the Estates Code seems to read when it uses the word guardianship, if you go back to the definitions, it explicitly states that when the use of the word guardianship occurs, we're talking about both temporary guardianship and permanent guardianship. So I don't think that would be a necessary distinction in this case.
Okay.
Had there been a permanent guardianship appointed, that certainly would be a different whole set of issues to have to address. Additionally, opposing counsel has raised the issue of the mootness of this matter because of the death of Eddie Yang and has cited two cases. I believe they're Mason and Zip. In those instances, we don't have a fact scenario that we have here where when you look at the application itself and you look at the record itself, that there aren't problems with the appointment of the guardianship. And those problems with the appointment of the guardianship create a deficient appointment of guardianship that should be challenged, should be reversed, because there are damages as a result of this guardianship. By appointing the guardianship, engaging the guardianship process, even with Eddie's death, Eddie is still harmed. Chinhua Wang has still been harmed by this guardianship. And specifically, all of these additional actors that had to step in, take place, the guardian, the guardian's attorney, which was himself, an attorney ad litem, opposing counsel and their attorney's fees, all took from Eddie himself, his estate, Chinhua Wang, and that has been an additional tax on this estate that should not have happened because this was a guardianship that should not have happened. And so there is a very clear harm that is different from the Zip case and the Mason case because those facts weren't apparent on the record. They weren't dealing with a very clearly inappropriately authorized guardianship. Even though they were challenged the guardianship, the court in those cases didn't get into facts that are similar to this case, which makes those cases distinguishable from ours. And for those reasons, this appeal, the appeal of the appointment of the guardianship, is not moot. And because the appeal...
I have a question to ask you in terms of your position in the case, your client's position. Is there an attack on terms of the finding of the trial judge that there was incapacity on the part of the ward of the temporary guardianship? You attack the fact that there was a finding of that he was incapacitated and needed a appointment of a guardian to supervise his personal business and financial interests.
In our brief, we have not attacked that, Your Honor, no.
Well, are you doing that today? That's what I'm asking you.
Yes, in so many words, we are. And additionally, because if we're attacking that application of incapacity, then that leads to why this entire appeal is...
What medical witness did you present to attack the capacity issue?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't hear your question.
Did you present evidence from a medical witness to attack the finding of that the trial court made that Mr. Wang was incapacitated?
No, Your Honor. We weren't able to do that. We only had 2 days' worth of notice to prepare for that hearing, and that goes directly toward our due process.
You understand
process
this was a temporary hearing and that there's often short notice time in terms of temporary hearings. There's even a requirement that the hearing be held within 10 days of service.
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor.
So you're attacking the process of an early service and early hearing in a temporary guardianship matter as it's set up under the statutes?
As the way, not in terms of the statute itself, but the way it was applied to these circumstances, certainly frustrates my client's right to due process of law. Notice
is 2 days enough time to get written pleadings together to respond in writing to the petition?
Yes. Okay. 2 days should be sufficient to at least have some written response.
All right. Thank you.
Yes. And because this appeal is not moot, the court incorrectly authorized guardianship in this matter, and the court did that for several reasons.
What relief can we grant you? Even if the court should not have authorized the guardianship, at this point there is no guardianship. I mean, what relief can this court give you?
In terms of authorizing the guardianship, there were several funds that were taken from Grace Wang's account, particularly at least the $70,000 that was, I guess, a central piece in what the hearing was about. Those funds were taken from her, placed in the registry of the court, and still remain outside of her grasp. And so that is certainly at least one area of relief in which this court can grant. If the guardianship was wrong in the first place and there are still funds from that guardianship that are deposited with the registry of the court, those funds can be given back to Grace Wang, including any access to any accounts that she is still being
granted.
Wouldn't
that be a matter for the trial court to determine? The disposition of funds pending in the trial court?
Well,
deposited with the trial court?
Certainly this court could remand this case back to the probate court with an opinion instructing the court to dispose of those funds in accordance with this court's opinion and with other areas of law. That's certainly at least one relief if the court feels that the trial court is in the best disposition to decide what to do with those funds, absolutely. The trial court, in its hearing, did so with a defective application, and the application was defective, and this was raised on appeal by the specialty estate counsel that Ms. Wang ended up retaining, and pointed out before the probate court that There was no proposed guardian. There was no name of a proposed guardian, the address of the proposed guardian, or the certifications that would qualify a proposed guardian in the appellee's application. And they raised that issue, but the court didn't correct it. The court still issued the guardianship. Additionally, the physician's report, the certification report, was not signed until 11/25/15, meaning that the report that discusses Eddie Yang's state of mind was not on file or was not signed until the day after the court made its ruling and was not on file until almost a month later. These are technical deficiencies that violate the estates code or they go against the estates code. And the estates code is very, very complex. It has a lot of systematic requirements that are necessary as a matter of public policy. The legislature has created a very complex array of measures to ensure that a person is not deprived of their personhood, that instead of there's a guardianship, there's a lessened form of guardianship that doesn't have all those powers, or that there's alternatives to guardianship. And for those reasons, the probate court erred and violated the estates code when it ordered the guardianship of Young Lo Yang. And this leaves appellant to his third point, or her third point, excuse me. In ordering the attorney's fees to be paid from Grace to the attorney ad litem is in violation of the estates code as well. Now, this section of the estates code, 1155.151C, does not have a lot of case law on it. In In re LaRue, the Dallas Court of Appeals addressed this issue, and in that instance, when that trial court, that probate court, ordered attorney's fees for five motions that were filed that were later called frivolous, the Dallas Court of Appeals reversed that probate court. The phrase in bad faith and without just cause is likened to the Rule 11 under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, that bad faith and just cause means a conscious doing of wrong for dishonest, discriminatory, or malicious purpose, and that there needs to be a motive or an element. You want to see that I'm out of time.
Yeah, complete your sentence, please.
And that there needs to be an element of that improper motive is an essential element of bad faith. These are all findings that need to be made by the trial court. Bad faith and unjust cause is a legal conclusion, not facts. And, Your Honors, for these reasons, we respectfully pray that you find for the appellant. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Nicely. All right. Then we have rebuttal by Mr. Henry.
Thank you, Chief. May it please the court, Chief Justice Livingston, Justice Walker, Justice Meyer. My name is Byron Henry, along with Aaron Pierce. We represent the appellees in this case, which are the applicants for the guardianship below. First, I'd like to address a question Justice Meyer asked with respect to the attacking a finding. There's been no attack on the findings of fact by the trial court with respect to incapacity. So they're binding on this court as long as there's evidence in the record to support that, and I believe you'll find that there's plenty of evidence with respect to testimony from the applicants and the ad litem regarding his capacity. So we believe that that's binding on this court on the incapacity issue, so I don't believe it would be appropriate for them to challenge it for the first time during oral argument. Secondly, with respect to Justice Walker's question about relief, certainly if they made a claim for funds, an affirmative claim for relief in the trial court, and that was extant at the time of the final order, and you believe there was something amiss with respect to the guardianship that cost them money, in other words, there's a justiciable issue with respect to something that affects Grace directly, there would be something for the trial court to do. But in response to your question, the only claims outstanding were ours. There's no written pleadings by them. They haven't challenged any findings of fact that Mr. Yang owned the funds, which are in the findings of fact as well, that she absconded with tens of thousands of his funds prior to the filing of the temporary guardianship, which necessitated the TRO, the freezing of the accounts, and the temporary guardianship because he was incapacitated. So there's nothing, to answer your question, Justice Walker, no relief you can grant because they don't have a claim for funds. They don't have a claim for relief. They have no written pleadings. This is akin to someone asking for a temporary injunction, getting it, the temporary injunction expiring, and then coming up here to the court and arguing about the fact that the temporary injunction was improperly granted in the civil context, which there's no rule that affects temporary guardianships any differently, this court would dismiss it as moot. There's no doubt that when temporary injunctions are in effect in a case, they affect people. And some people may claim it's a wrongful injunction. There's a claim for that. You can file for wrongful injunction. You can file a claim for a malicious prosecution if you believe someone obtained an injunction in bad faith. There's a tort claim for that. It's recognized. But we don't have that here. There is no claims for relief by the appellants in this case, so there's nothing to remand to the trial court. Going back to their first point with respect to mootness, I believe counsel has conflated both mootness and jurisdiction. First, you have to determine whether you ever had jurisdiction before you can determine whether the case is moot. And here they have two obstacles to overcome, the first of which is all of the case law. There's not one case, whether it's Hester, this court's decision in Hart, the Cunningham case that we cited in our brief, that says that a order appointing a temporary guardian is not appealable, from which a notice of appeal is due within 20 days. In fact, Cunningham says it could also be treated as final based on the weird way probate cases have multiple final judgments at different stages. But that's not this court's opinion. This court's opinion is Hart, and Hart says it is appealable regardless of whether or not there's a debate or the statute may be ambiguous. This court's already ruled. It is appealable. It's due within 20 days. No motions extend the time under the Supreme Court's Hone v. Hanifin case. Therefore, their deadline to appeal the temporary guardianship was within 20 days. Much like a temporary injunction, if you don't appeal a temporary injunction, it stays in effect till trial. If a permanent injunction is granted, you can appeal that from the final judgment. If the temporary injunction expires, there's no relief. It expires, it's moot. That takes us to the second point. Despite the fact that their appeal notice of appeal was untimely, even if it were timely and the court had jurisdiction, the death of the ward and the fact that the temporary guardianship order is no longer in effect moots the appeal. In other words, you would be reviewing an order that is ineffective, not just by its own terms because it was temporary, like a temporary injunction, but also because the ward has died. And the cases we cite clearly say, I believe, that when the ward dies, it terminates a guardianship and moots an appeal, except in a rare in a exception set out in the Zip case where there is a dispute as to who's going to settle the estate, and those cases deal with when a permanent guardian has already been appointed and there's a dispute between a permanent guardian over the estate and an administrator of the ward's estate. When that dispute occurs, this court could hear a dispute over who's the right person or whether a guardianship was appropriate, because removing the guardian would elevate the administrator of the estate to the proper person. Leaving the guardian in place could cause a conflict between settling the estate. There's no evidence in the record, and no one has made the argument in this case that there's any dispute as to who would settle the estate. Likewise, there was never a permanent guardian appointed. So the temporary guardian that expires on its own terms and goes away could never dispute with someone higher on the chain with respect to settling the estate, because the temporary guardian never even became a permanent guardian. So here there is no dispute as to who should settle the estate, and therefore, to the extent the court ever had jurisdiction, the death of the ward and the expiration of the temporary guardianship order by its own terms would moot any appeal of that issue, which would take with it the process issues, evidentiary issues, and other defects that occurred at the hearing, because you wouldn't review the process at a temporary injunction hearing for a temporary injunction that was no longer in effect and for relief you couldn't grant. Likewise, there's no sense going into translators, doctor certificates, and the sufficiency of the evidence at a trial on an order that is no longer in effect. So our position is all of the issues, save for possibly the personal liability for attorney's fees under the probate code, which does affect the appellant directly and continues to affect the appellant as a result of the order, regardless of the mootness of the guardianship, that probably, in our opinion, or my opinion, survives and can be reviewed by the court because she has a final judgment against her. Question about whether or not her notice of appeal was timely for that order, because that order was back in May. And with respect to the stages argument, that stage of the proceeding where the guardian ad litem was appointed, did their service, and was paid, and she was ordered to pay, occurred back in May. The notice of appeal wasn't filed until 30 days after the final order closing the guardianship. So I would just caution the court to note that the order that they're appealing, the one we believe they have the right to appeal from, is 4 months old at the time they file their notice of appeal. If the court determines that is not a distinctive stage in the proceeding, then that would be merged in with the final judgment and their notice of appeal would have been timely. But if it was a stage in the proceeding that was distinct for purposes of the probate code and the Supreme Court's case law, there is also a question whether that notice of appeal was also timely. We have not addressed that in depth in our brief. We know the court looks at its own jurisdiction on its own, but I just wanted to point that out to the court. We don't have very much of a dog in the fight with respect to attorney's fees. It's not against our client. It's not in favor of our client, I apologize. And therefore, we just pointed out a few points in the record where we believe the court may have drawn evidence to support the finding on no just cause or bad faith. I would point out that the Dallas Court of Appeals opinion in Ray LaRoe is instructive because it's one of the first cases to go into this in depth. I would caution the court on one count. LaRoe, you're writing on nearly a clean slate on this new statute, and therefore requiring a party under a statute which says bad faith or without just cause to meet the Rule 13 bad faith for the sole purpose of harassment is awfully limiting on that statutory provision. The Dallas Court of Appeals wrote an opinion that is very limiting. That may be what this court determines the legislature's intent is with respect to the probate court's discretion, but I find it the disjunctive or was omitted from the Dallas Court of Appeals decision, and they consistently referred to bad faith and without just cause in their opinion, and so I believe it might have led them to consider using the shorthand Rule 13 sanctions for purposes, and I think that might be a little more restrictive if you read the entire section than what the legislature intended. That just goes to the court writing for the Fort Worth, for your district. This would be your first opinion on the scope of that provision, that statutory provision, and the discretion of a trial court. So while I think in Ray LaRoe and the statute are good places to start, I believe it was very restrictive on a trial court's discretion. Basically, if you're not guilty of sanctionable conduct, the trial court can't give you can't award a portion of fees. And in this case, I would point out the trial court heard evidence regarding Grace's conduct. Of course, they paint the picture in their brief putting all the evidence in favor of their client. In an abuse of discretion review, when you're looking at the evidence, you're going to review only the evidence in favor of the trial court's ruling and not the evidence, unless it's conclusive and undisputed, you're not going to look at the evidence against the trial court's ruling. And here, basically, the trial court heard lots of testimony about the appellant attempting to change beneficiaries, their exhibits trying to change beneficiaries to her children and to herself while Mr. Yang was incapacitated. There was, of course, the testimony about the multiple withdrawals of money, which necessitated the trial court to basically ask the ad litem to file a TRO, handwritten, by the way, at the application for temporary guardianship, so that she could act on a TRO to freeze these accounts before they were dissipated any further. And then if you just read the records, you can see that the trial court drew from that evidence that the party was there solely for her own benefit to basically oppose the guardianship to hide the fact that she was bilking the estate. I believe the court probably had the discretion to award her 20% of the fees, which ended up being just over $1,200 of a day of a hearing that cost, between the ad litem and my client's attorney's fees, well over $10,000. She ended up getting ordered to pay $1,270, I believe.
Mr. Henry.
Yes.
Your statement that there was findings by the court, or that the court addressed in its findings of fact and conclusion of law, the $70,000 in cash, I read that in finding of fact number 14, there is a reference to the $70,000. Is that 14 and 15, and is that the area of, are those the findings of fact that you're relying on in making the statement you just made about she wrongfully withdrew the money?
Yes, and I was also, because they didn't ask for additional findings or whatnot, all findings necessary to support the judgment are implied, and I was also referencing the evidence as well. But yes, those findings occur in the supplemental clerk's record at pages 14 and 16. The ones I believe the trial court would have been relying on are findings 14 and 15 on page 14, 35 and 36 on page 16, 5 and 6 on page 22, 18 to 23 on pages 29 to 30, and 1-3 on page 31, and that was all referencing the supplemental clerk's record. So I believe those would support, those are what we're alleging in our brief in our section on this attorney's fees issue would support.
Is there a conclusion of law that you're relying upon?
Those, pardon me, Justice Meyer, those were both the findings of fact and the conclusions of law that support that. So the last ones I was reading on 2930.
Are the conclusions of law?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, okay.
So unless the court has any questions with respect to the jurisdictional issues, I will yield back the rest of my time, and we ask the court, I guess the relief we would be requesting is first and foremost to reverse the, to dismiss the appeal of the guardianship order as either because you lack jurisdiction or because you lack jurisdiction because it's moot, and affirm the trial court's award of attorney's fees against Ms. Grace, on the assumption, of course, that the notice of appeal and the court has jurisdiction to review that order as well. Thank you.
I have one question, just to follow up on the findings. I guess it's within that final judgment. how much time had passed after the ward died and the closing of the guardianship? Do you have that?
The ward passed away on January 24, 2016. The order to award fees against the appellant occurred on May the 6th, 2016, and that's on page 241 and 242 of the clerk's record. The final order closing, discharging the temporary guardian and settling the entire guardianship occurred on August 18th, 2016.
Okay, so we can look at that order and understand where the proceeds and the assets that had been held in the temporary guardianship, where they went?
Not just that order, because there was a number of orders. Okay. There is a number of orders that were entered from after January 24, 2016, they pay, for instance, pay the ad litem in May. There was also an order, and I don't have it here handy, but there's also the order to pay our client's fees. There was an interim award to the temporary guardian as well as expenses. So there was a number of awards that occur or orders that were signed between January and August. The final order closing everything and shutting the whole thing down was in August. But I believe they have attached most of the orders to their brief in the appendix, kind of in chronological order that occurred. Okay. I would also just point out that they don't represent Mr. Yang in this case, so they don't have standing, even if the problem was some of Mr. Yang's money was taken and spent on attorney's fees improperly. They wouldn't be able to complain about that on appeal either. That would be obviously disposed of or discussed in the probate proceeding, which is, by the way, it's not in the record, so I don't want to stray too much. But there is a probate proceeding. Obviously, the ward died, and there's a probate proceeding with respect to his death going on as we speak. So,
okay.
There's no mention of the probate proceedings in any of the pleadings that I've written.
Yeah, there's one going on, but obviously Mr. Yang is not represented by any parties here at this hearing, so any complaint that his money may have been used for something amiss would be inappropriate at this point, and it's not part of the case or part of the briefs.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, we have rebuttal. Mr. Nicely?
Yes.
Okay.
May it please the court. Continuing with opposing counsel's addressing N. Ray LaRue, this is the first instance, I believe, for this court, just as the Dallas Court of Appeals recognized that their opinion was one of the very first opinions about 1155.151. In Ray LaRue, the Court of Appeals attacks the probate court's finding for several reasons. One of the big ones was that the assessment of fees for the motions has been in bad faith or with unjust cause was almost 9 months after those events allegedly occurred. And the Court of Appeals, toward the end of their opinion, attacked how that was almost moot itself in terms of, well, the bad actions would have happened much earlier, 9 months earlier. Yet now you're asking for sanctions toward the very end. Well, that's exactly what happened in this case. The application for temporary guardian was in November of 2015, and as opposing counsel points out, that the order was in May, the final order was sometime in August, several months later. And then the Court of Appeals directly addressed at how cold that issue was. There was no request at the temporary guardianship for attorney's fees under this statute. Ms. Jones's actual request for attorney's fees does not ask for 20% from my client. It was not until the day of the hearing that the probate court included this 20% $1,200 assessment against my client. And so just like in that case, they should have raised those objections at the hearing. And additionally, the court found, and it's what I would argue is a conclusion of law placed in with the findings of fact, because the opinion itself, the advisory opinion from the Dallas Court of Appeals, addresses how addresses how bad faith and or without just cause is more of a legal finding, that there needs to be actions that support that. So the mere statement that Grace acted with acted in bad faith or without just cause should be treated as a legal conclusion by this court, and that other things need to support that. And there needs to be facts within the record that support and that shows there's a conscious doing of wrong for dishonest, discriminatory, and malicious purpose. If this court chooses to follow Texas Rule of Civil Procedure Rule 13 standard and apply bad faith
How do we even have to get there when we have a finding in the trial court's finding approval of attorney ad litem fees for Deborah Jones, number 5? The finding under that paragraph H, finding number 5, says, taking into account the factors to be considered under applicable case law and Texas disciplinary rules of professional conduct, the amount of $6,371 is basically, for a certain period, approved and ordered to be paid 80% from Young Lo Yang's estate and 20% from funds belonging to Grace for professional legal services performed by Ms. Jones that were reasonable, necessary, and customary for professional legal services in Denton County. I mean, how do we get behind that finding?
That finding sounds like when it references the rules of professional conduct, that $6,000, given her the county, her expertise, how long she's been there, that $6,000 is worthy of paying her, that it's appropriate legal fee given the rules of professional responsibility. Only as a little bit of a bit of that text does the court go off and say, okay, then 80% from the estate of Young Lo Yang, 20% from Grace. But in that finding, it doesn't say what under 1155.151 does it say for this reason, because Grace did X, because Grace did Y, because Grace did Z.
What requires that?
Well, 1155.151 requires that the court find that there was bad faith or unjust cause. And that should be read as finding a legal conclusion, and therefore there needs to be facts that support that there was bad faith or facts that there supports unjust cause. In this instance, Grace Wang, and this is what the court said, in objecting to the application for temporary guardian, that she acted in bad faith or without just cause. She objected to an application that was defective on its face, when she had only 2 days' notice, didn't have a translator, there was no physician's report that was signed within 120 days of the hearing, all legitimate bases. And I see that I've run out of time. May it please the court. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel who are here and for all of your briefing and your arguments today. We really appreciate that. Your case will be submitted or is now submitted. And you all are excused from the court, and we'll call the second matter for argument.